So I'd like to start or commence by thanking the conference organisers for inviting me to present at this European Conference on Religion, Spirituality and Health. And it's a great privilege to be here with you in Bern, to be able to speak this morning, sharing with you some of my thoughts and reflections on the relationships between dignity, spirituality and health, and the importance of these concepts, especially with the focus on caring for older people. So when I received this invitation, I thought, what should I discuss? So rather than undertaking another piece of empirical study, I thought I would analyse and reflect on existing data sources. So I've analysed four recent reports that have been published in England and in Wales to see what they say about the concepts of spirituality, dignity and identity and the relevance of these when caring for older people. What I won't do is read the title of my presentation. I think it's a grand title. But basically what I'm saying is I'm going to focus on spirituality, dignity, and what happens when these are absent in the care of older people. So I'd like to start by saying, is it not a sad indictment in the United Kingdom that we have a world-class health service that is at the leading edge of scientific and technological advancements? Yet there is a growing evidence base in published reports suggesting we seem to have missed the boat in terms of our primary values of care and caring. My presentation will address some of the findings from an in-depth analysis of four reports published in England between 2009 and 2011. These reports highlight some serious failings in the standards and quality of care provided to older people, primarily within acute hospital settings. So a little bit about me. I was appointed in August 2008 as Professor in Dignity of Care for Older People. And as Peter said, this is a joint appointment between the Faculty of Health, Staffordshire University, and the Shrewsbury and Telford Hospital NHS Trust. And I understand it's the first appointment of its kind in the United Kingdom and indeed internationally. So while I'm delighted and feel privileged to have been appointed to this role, I do feel a sense of sadness and unease. Why do I think this? First, to appoint professors in dignity of care for any group of people means something has gone fundamentally wrong in our health and social care system. Second, when I undertook my undergraduate training to be a registered nurse, dignity was an integral part of the caring process, something innate and intuitive, a fundamental principle of care and caring. And a couple of weeks ago, I was in Bergen in Norway and talking to nursing colleagues, and it seems that some of the issues and challenges that we're facing in the UK regarding caring for older people may be generic across Europe. So recent epidemiological and demographic predictions reveal that modern health and social care are facing a crisis of unprecedented proportions with regards to meeting the needs of an ever-aging population. The United Nations Department of Economic Affairs, the Population Division, predicts that increases in the proportion of older persons 60 years or older are being accompanied by declines in the proportions of the young under age 15. Globally, the population of older persons is growing by 2% each year, considerably faster than the population as a whole. For at least the next 25 years, the older population is expected to continue growing more rapidly than other age groups. The growth rate of those 60 or older will reach 2.8% annually in 2025 to 2030. And such rapid growth will require far-reaching economic and social adjustments in most countries. These alarming demographic trends are attributed to a decrease in fertility and the increase in longevity due to developments in health and medicines, meaning more people are living into the old category. For example, the median age of the United Kingdom population, that is the age at which half the population is younger and half the population is older, has increased from 35.4 years to 39.7 years. This means that there are more older people living in the UK than younger people. The fastest population increases have been in the oldest old, those aged 85 and over. And between 1985 and 2010, the percentage of the population aged 85 and over increased from 1% to 2%, with the number aged 85 and over more than doubling from nearly 0.7 million to reach over 1.4 million by 2010. By 2035, it is predicted that the number of people aged 85 and over will be almost 2.5 times larger than in 2010, reaching 3.5 million and accounting for 5% of the total UK population. And I've tried to show the demographics for these increases across Europe. So the impact of ageing, of an ageing population, what I'm not going to do is go through all the slides. You can look at that. But it's a fallacy to think that longevity is only associated with an increase in morbidity or comorbidity. It is also a grave misconception to think that all older people do not make a valuable contribution to the needs of our societies. Yet, the danger when looking at the demographics and epidemiological data I've just presented associated with an ageing population is to focus on the potential burden and negative impact. Not all older people will experience a decline in physical health, nor will they require the services of our health and welfare states. Many older people live full and active, meaningful lives. This one's titled Skydiving at 92. I like this picture titled Skydiving at 92. It illustrates my point that growing old is not always about a declining health or indeed youthful spirit of adventure and fun. How many of us have been skydiving? However, for some older people, aging is associated with a declining health and a loss of independence, resulting often in hospitalisation. In my opinion, in the United Kingdom health sector, or the United Kingdom health sector is not adequately prepared to meet the challenges and needs of caring for older people, especially within an acute hospital setting, and find it difficult to support people, for example, with dementia. So these are the four reports that I've analysed that were published between 2009 and 2011. So listening to the UK media and reviewing the seemingly vast number of damning reports is enough to strike fear and disgust into the heart of anyone reading them, and indeed wider society. However, not everything written in the reports I analysed is bad. They're examples of excellent practice and standards of care. Yet, there is no room or excuse for prejudice, discrimination, abuse, or neglect in whatever guise it is manifested. Yet there must be a sense of balance and proportion. It is easy to be swept away on a tide of revolution and revulsion, but this emotion needs to be tempered with caution and reality. The media attention and the published reports rightly alert the public to the shortfalls and failings in the health and social care sectors. Yet these do very little to raise awareness of the excellent standards of care provided by most individuals within health and social care settings. For example, the Care Quality Commission published the results of the 2001 inpatient hospital survey recently, and 79% of respondents reported that overall they were always treated with respect and dignity while they were in hospital. And further, respondents rated the overall care they received 43% as excellent, 35% as very good, and 14% as good, 6% as fair, with only 3% stating their care was poor. Yet we must explore why, for some older people, and perhaps it's the 6 and 3%, the experience of care is not always positive and of the highest standard and quality. And that's what are published in these reports. The reports present a picture of institutions, organisations and individuals failing to respond to the need of older people with sensitivity, with dignity, with care and compassion, people deprived of the most essential or fundamental standards of care. So just a little bit about the two associations who published the reports. The Patients Association described itself in the following terms: as a healthcare charity which for nearly 50 years has advocated for better access to accurate and independent information for patients and the public, equal access to high quality care for patients, and the right for patients to be involved in all aspects of decision making regarding their healthcare. The second one is the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman, and they describe their role as: we consider complaints about government departments and agencies in the UK and the NHS in England. Our role is to consider complaints that the government departments, a range of other public bodies in the UK and the NHS in England, have not acted properly or fairly or have provided a poor service. We aim to provide an independent, high-quality complaint handling service that rights individual wrongs, drives improvement in public services and informs public policy. So they're the two organisations who've highlighted these failings in the care of older people. So before I proceed looking at the findings from the analysis, there is a need to outline what I mean by dignity and spirituality, and how, in my opinion, these two concepts are inseparable. I will start by drawing your attention to the work undertaken by Cardiff University in association with other European partners into the dignity of older Europeans and in their model of dignity. The first aspect refers to the dignity that we all possess as humans, and from which stems the idea of universal human rights. We are all equal with this kind of dignity. The second is dignity of merit, and this can be formal or informal. A formal person of particular rank or office may possess certain rights as a result of their office. So the fact that many of us are working in professional roles gives us a formal or an informal merit in terms of dignity and an expectation in terms of the standards of care that we should provide. And this type of dignity is usually earned, and the informal, this may be earned through their deeds of sacrifice and perhaps altruism. Dignity of moral stature, this is based upon preserving one's own moral identity, and one maintains this through acting according to principles, and this can be lost losing the respect of others. And in the UK, I keep thinking of the Members of Parliament expenses scandal, and how that's shattered the image of Members of Parliament within UK society. And finally, dignity of personal identity. This can be lost through a violation of the person, physical assault, or by humiliation. And for me, reading and analysing these reports, that is what's absent. That's what's present in this analysis. The acts of humiliation and the acts or the violation of the identity of the person. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. So I would argue that each of these forms of dignity will never be upheld and preserved in health and social care practice if we do not acknowledge the unique spirituality residing within every person. In the United Kingdom, and I would add internationally, many of our health and social care policy documents now emphasise an holistic model of health and social care, with a shift away from a purely physical reductionist medical model. Some models of holistic care are presented by a pie chart divided into four distinct separate dimensions: physical, psychological, social, and spiritual. For me, this represents a reductionist view of the individual. Spirituality is something that permeates all dimensions of the person, as this slide suggests. It is at the core of the person, radiating outwards, and I'm fully aware that not everybody subscribes to this philosophy. I've often been criticised in my writing on spirituality for not providing a definition. And this has been deliberate on my part, as I don't think this concept can be adequately defined by language and words. Neither do I think spiritual aspects of life can be contained or put into box. Haru Narayanasamy says there is no authoritative definition of spirituality, and I agree with him totally. However, when I did a rehearsal for my professorial inaugural lecture in April 2009, colleagues insisted that I write a definition. So after almost 15 years of nearly getting away with it, I had to put pen to paper. My definition is based upon my personal experience and reflection and an analysis of the empirical work that I've undertaken with patients, with members of the public, and with a whole range of healthcare professionals. For me, spirituality is not an intellectual activity. It is central to identity and relevant to all people. So this is taken from the Royal College of Nursing and their definition of spirituality. So in summary, spirituality is all of these: hope, trust, meaning, purpose, forgiveness, belief and faith, values, love and relationship, morality, creativity and self-expression. However, a closer analysis of many of the definitions or attributes of spirituality, and my own included, suggests one area of omission is how spirituality relates to concepts of suffering, pain, death, and even manifestations of evil. Many of us are caring for people who are suffering and in pain. Healthcare debate on spirituality must start to engage more meaningfully with the concepts of suffering, pain, and evil, and how these relate to health, well-being, and the identity of the person. We may well need to look at the work of some of the Scandinavian nursing theorists, for example, Professor Kari Martinsson from Norway and Katie Erickson, Professor Erickson from Finland, and their writing on care and vulnerability and the suffering human being. I say this because when you look at the findings from the reports that I've analysed, rather than alleviating suffering and pain, healthcare, organisations, professionals and individuals have been a catalyst or instruments of unnecessary suffering. In some instances, these deficiencies in caring have led to premature death of the individual. Therefore, the positive, affirming and life-enhancing attributes associated with spirituality do not truly capture the reality of our human experiences, either physically or metaphysically. So the synergy and symbiotic nature and relationship of spirituality and dignity are evident in those writing on the subject of dignity and care, as outlined in this definition by Fenton and Mitchell. The centrality of spirituality is highlighted within an holistic model, emphasising the importance of uniqueness, individuality, empowerment, control, and involving people in decisions about their care. So the methodology in terms of the analysis. I read through each report, annotating and highlighting key points and words. I exported all the accounts in the four reports into a Microsoft Word document and conducted a simple keyword analysis using the find and highlight facilities. I pulled out keywords and mapped these against 9 dignity domains that are evident in much of the health and social care literature on dignity. In the acute hospital where I work, we have developed a dignity in care indicator tool based on the following 9 domains. And from this, we have constructed a patient survey that seeks to measure the patient's experience and perceptions of the quality of care. So I will share with you an example of one of the 9 dignity domains around autonomy. So the 9 domains are the following: autonomy, communication, nutrition, eating and drinking, privacy, personal hygiene, pain control, social inclusion, which would include people's personal belief, value, spiritual belief, issues around end-of-life care, and then safety. So what I haven't got time to do is to go through all of that in terms of what areas we would explore. So the 9 dignity domains have been identified as outlined, and these reflect some of the key attributes outlined by Fenton and Mitchell. Analysis of the 4 reports shows that those NHS organisations named in the reports fail to uphold the dignity of individuals in some or if not all of these domains. Therefore, how we capture and measure the patient's and public's experience regarding dignity is of paramount importance. Crucially, the measuring of quality and the patient experience should involve a range of methods and observations, so this is only one element of capturing that quality, and the general public themselves. So, for example, the broad area of autonomy is concerned with a number of descriptors such as, does the individual feel involved in decisions about their care? Do they feel able and supported to complain and raise questions? And do we have respect for the individual's belongings and their own personal identity? And this is an area that's often neglected in healthcare practice. And this is just an example of some of the questions that were integrated into the patient survey. Demographics, 59 accounts of care were provided across the four reports. The episode of care occurred between 2005 and 2011. The age range was between 52 and 99 years, with the mean 82.3. 19 males and 40 females. What is saddening is 44% of those people, 44 of those individuals deceased either in hospital or soon after discharge from hospital. And that's who the people complained, who raised the complaints with the Patients Association or the Parliamentary Ombudsman. So like I said, the saddest thing is that these reports highlight the case of bad care where a relative is available to speak up for the patient. Yet the Patients Association rightly states that there are many vulnerable and elderly patients that have no one to speak up for them and no relatives to challenge the care that nurses, indeed all health care and social care staff, are giving them. So they don't have a voice, many older people. Reasons for hospital were quite broad, but the main reason was an issue of dementia, fall and fracture, infection. The keyword analysis was conducted on all reports in the nine domains, and again, I'm just referring this to the one related to autonomy. So the analysis read to six broad themes in terms of what these reports tell us. And I've broken them down into poor standards of care, erosion of core values, objectification and humiliation, perception of role, model and focus of care delivery, and organisation and systemic failure. The first one, this theme concerns the poor standards of care provided. This was a recurrent theme in all the reports, and many people complained that they were deprived or had limited access to the basic, and I would rather use the word fundamental, aspects of care. Nutrition and fluid intake were not assessed, or people were not given sufficient assistance. Patients and families reported that staff didn't seem to care, adopting a rude and inappropriate attitudes. Families complained that their loved ones did not receive adequate assistance with personal care and hygiene. And the accounts present a picture of staff that are uncaring at times, cruel and disrespectful of the need of older people. Patients indicated that sometimes staff treated them roughly when moving or providing treatment. And just identify some of the questions from the report, from the accounts provided by the complainants, and words like starved to death in front of me. So that was the level of emotion that was felt. Lack of care and compassion or erosion of core values. Staff were not sensitive to the needs of those in their care. They did not listen to the concern raised. They projected an image that patients and families are an inconvenience, and some of the comment reveals that staff lack compassion and empathy, in that there was little awareness of sensitivity of those who requested or sought assistance. Objectification and humiliation, I think this is one of the hardest things to accept in the report in terms of how we'd view as individuals. It would appear that the attitudes and behaviours exhibited by some of the staff in the reports suggest there has been an erosion or a loss of what it means to be a person. Patients reported that they were made to feel like objects, and words such as pieces of meat indicates that those involved felt so devalued, deprived of dignity, that they no longer felt human or of any worth. and I think it's pretty explicit in those reports. Perception of role. I've labelled this theme perception of role because in some of the situations outlined, the staff displayed a total disregard for the people that they are employed to care for, patients and members of the public. So the accounts in the analysis bring into question the model of care and the focus of care delivery. The overall impression is that care was not focused on the needs of the individual and the person, but on meeting the demands of the organisation. Some of the practices described are quite shameful and shocking. To have a family member describe that their father was in so much pain that he squealed like a piglet, in my eyes, is criminal. The model of care delivery outlined is based on the abuse of power and a total disrespect for the vulnerable in their care. So the analysis suggests a catalogue of failures: environmental, systemic, organisational, attitudinal. One frustration for many was the inability of staff to consult and communicate when arranging discharge. The accounts give the impression that the NHS does not respond well when complaints or allegations of poor care are made against them, with some complaints taking almost 4 years to be resolved or addressed. So I've painted quite a bleak picture. So what is the solution, in my humble opinion? So the phrase treatment versus care is an excerpt of a transcript from an interview I held with an older gentleman who was dying from terminal lung cancer. And the gentleman's words still resound in my ears. He said, "Wilf, we get treatment in the hospital and care in the hospice." And this phrase, I feel, has significance and poignancy for all of us working in healthcare. The fact that this gentleman was able to make a distinction between treatment and care strikes at the heart of some of the issues that are impacting on health and social care in these reports. The phrase implies treatment is different to care, and care takes precedence over treatment. So what do I mean? Or what did this gentleman? So what is treatment? Someone technically proficient, good at doing their job in a time and manner that is appropriate to the needs of the individual. In summary, a practitioner or a care worker who displays technical competence and proficiency. Yet despite technical competence and proficiency, the use of the word treatment can present the picture of someone almost robotic in their actions, someone detached and emotionally disconnected from the process of care. So what is caring? The word care conjures up a picture of someone warm. Someone takes time, provides a presence. Care, or more precisely, caring is about being valued and accepted as a unique person with a unique set of needs. And let me illustrate this further. The gentleman elaborated and qualified his statement by saying, "Wilf, there's a hard nurse and a soft nurse. The hard nurse approaches you with the opening such as, 'What's this pain in your chest?' The gentleman said instantly, 'I know she is not concerned with me as a person, but with the condition that's brought me into the hospital, the biological, the scientific.' While the soft nurse asks, 'How are you feeling this afternoon? How are your family and how are your wife?' They are concerned with me as a person and my situation, the practical, the humanistic, the caring aspects." So this illustration tells us two fundamental things about the patients that we serve and the public. They want care, not just treatment. And importantly, they can distinguish the type of practitioner who is likely to provide that care. So you can substitute the top of this with whatever professional role we work in, either a hard nurse, hard doctor, hard social worker, soft social worker. So I think crucially, the gentleman's phrase tells us that health and social care is a blend of treatment and care. And healthcare professionals need to be a blend of both the hard and the soft, the scientific and the caring. So what's absent or what's needed? So the preliminary findings from this analogy suggest that some healthcare organisations are failing to recognise the uniqueness of the individual. This may be a result of systemic failure for the reason failure, the reasons for which are numerous and far complex. The net result is the general public feel that this has had a significant and detrimental impact on the organisations to provide high standards of care. My reflection suggests that spirituality is an integral part of the individual. Spirituality and dignity are not competing concepts, since both shape the identity of the individual, influencing attitudes, values, and ultimately our actions and approach to care, and the overall quality and experience of the person's care. These reports highlight that healthcare organisations must give careful consideration to its personal identity, since this shapes the identity and ultimately values of those receiving and delivering care. So organisational value culture breeds individual, personal, professional value and culture. At the moment, the experience of some older patients and their relatives falls into the category of neglect and abuse, in that it fails to acknowledge and care for the needs of the person. By refocusing attention on spirituality in conjunction with dignity, this will enable all working in healthcare to reinstate a person-centred and relationship-centred approach to care. And it might combat some of the target, outcome, consumerist and bureaucratic agendas that have perverted healthcare in recent times. So just to conclude, the findings from this analysis present us with a bleak and stark reality. And I must stress, not everything in healthcare is as good as it should or could be, but neither is it as bad as these reports might suggest. The reasons for this are complex and numerous. However, in my opinion, some of the major failings highlighted can be quickly resolved by placing the individual at the heart of everything that we strive to do. In the UK, some organisations have lost sight of the importance of people and the value of human dignity and life. These seem to have been replaced with a cold, uncaring attitude that does not heal but brings suffering, pain, and for some, premature death. Therefore, healthcare, especially within the United Kingdom, must undertake a whole system review. We must continue in our drive to re-establish and safeguard our core values and principles of caring. Spirituality and dignity remind and enable us to refocus our attention on the people who are in receipt and provide care, not on the targets and the waiting times or the financial constraints that can detract us from our primary goal. There needs to be a greater recognition and value within society of the important contribution those in caring roles provide, and this should be acknowledged and sufficiently enumerated. Above all, there must be an open, honest and transparent culture where people can challenge and raise questions without fear of intimidation or retribution. Above all, we must ask ourselves, who do I or who do patients consider me to be? Am I the hard or the soft nurse that the patient told me? Thank you for listening.
Well, thank you for a very interesting presentation, and especially the concept of dignity.
Yeah.
Needs far more attention than it gets.
Yep.
Now, I wanted to start with what would be the picture in your view for the elder psychiatric patients, because that's a problem apart, I think. Yep. But what is your view on that?
Well, I think one of the challenges we face in the United Kingdom is how we care specifically for people with dementia. And my background is in acute care, so not mental health. Okay. But I know the biggest challenge we face in caring for people with dementia is when they come into an acute hospital.
Uh-huh.
We don't have the skills, we don't have the knowledge, we don't have the expertise in order to care for people with dementia adequately. Not just dementia, but with other mental health problems. How do we differentiate between delirium, depression, dementia? How do we screen? How do we support? And in the UK, there's been a lot of work placed on this in terms of the government have launched a national dementia strategy in order to assist with screening, with assessment. Mm-hmm. So, but it is a big challenge.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, we have time for questions and discussion. Gentlemen at the back. One moment, please.
Mike Sheldon from the UK. Fully recognize exactly what you're talking about. But in my experience, and this is from my wife, who tried to go back to nursing after a family, and one or two others, they were horrified at the teaching, which was also professional and scientific. We must become little doctors. And they refused to go back to nursing because the caring was left out altogether. So my question to you is your message heard in the upper echelons of the nursing profession?
I agree totally. I think there's a danger, though, to assume that some of the challenges and the issues that we're facing in nursing and in healthcare generally are as a result of the move into higher education and professionalisation of the in terms of improving the professional standing, educational standing of the profession. I think there are issues around that move, but I think it's a reflection of wider society. Healthcare, nursing, nurses, I as an individual, reflect the values of wider society. One of the things I've been criticised for are two things. One is, I agree totally, there's been a fragmentation of nursing. Nursing is no longer focusing on caring, and caring has been devolved to an unregulated workforce, in my opinion. So the things I was once responsible for in safeguarding nutrition, the fundamental needs of the person around personal hygiene and privacy, they've now been given to another unregulated group of people. So my question to nursing generally, internationally, is what is nursing? And what is our unique selling point in terms of a nursing profession? What is it that we as nurses do? And my message hasn't been heard, I don't think. I keep trying. Yeah, thank you.
Hello, it's Sheila Furness from the University of Bradford. Unfortunately, I share some of your concerns about some of the poor standards that we're seeing, not only in hospitals, but care homes. But I think you did say that compassion was innate at one time, but I think, unfortunately, when you look at before the NHS and Community Care Act, where we had people with mental ill health, people with learning difficulties, old people, people who'd been seen as erring from what was considered normal, being incarcerated in asylums and institutions. And, you know, I have colleagues, friends, who actually stood by and didn't challenge some of the poor practices that did go on. And so I wonder, though, is there something more insidious there about this sort of lack of compassion? Is it the medical model? Is it, you know, because we've seen examples where people have been dehumanised over time. And there was an attempt to obviously professionalise nursing, I think, to tackle at some of these sort of core issues that you're talking about. And I don't know if you've got any views on that, because it's very difficult to measure, you know, about poor practice. And these particular reports are obviously highlighting some of the worst case examples as well, which are unacceptable.
Yeah. I think what you're saying is it's pretty complex. And when I look at my professional journey, I started as a young teenager as what we call a nursing assistant, as an auxiliary nurse working in a psychogeriatric hospital with patients with dementia. It was a locked ward, and many of those patients were restrained physically, chemically. They were put into chairs that were tipped back with trays put in. So I think it's a matter of perspective. Where I'm not going to stand here and say everything is bad in terms of the way health and social care has evolved. It hasn't. There's been some tremendous achievement and tremendous development in the way that nurses are prepared, the knowledge, the value. But we haven't to lose sight of, at that same time, where is the caring, where is the compassion, and what is that? Why has that been eroded? And I don't know, I think there are numerous reasons. Increased bureaucracy in the NHS, in social care, in terms of removing nurses from patients. So there's plenty of forms and assessments to do, but who's doing the caring? So I think that's one reason. One is about nurses moving into a whole range of specialist roles. And one of the terms I've came up with is pseudo-doctor. I'm not a doctor. I didn't train as a medical doctor. I trained as a nurse. but there's a lot of nurses who are doing roles that were once performed by our medical colleagues. So there's been an increase in specialisation. So I think it's far complex.
Well, thank you very much for that very interesting contribution. I'm Jacqueline Watts from the Open University, and I wanted just to try and develop the point about compassion.
Yeah.
I've recently been looking at the work of Ian Wilkinson, who has published what I would consider to be a seminal work on suffering.
Yeah.
And it's a very multifaceted monograph. At the core of his conceptualization of suffering is the construct of depersonalization.
Yeah.
And I think this is very pertinent for our consideration of compassion. And the question I wanted to really ask you, particularly as I have a role in some aspects of medical education, particularly in relation to end-of-life care, is can we really expect to teach compassion?
Well, I think that's an...
Is this a learned behaviour, or is it innate?
Yep.
I actually feel that this is a really critical question for all types of professional health and social care tasks.
Yep.
And when I was reading Ian Wilkinson's work, I felt very demoralised, because I felt that some of the ways in which within the educational domain we try to impart values, ethics, moral standards seems to circumvent this really critical core value of compassion. So sorry to offer you such a protracted comment, but I feel very dismal about it all.
But what reassures me, working at university, working in across a whole range of sectors, there are excellent people out there who provide compassionate, high-quality care. So I think it's, again, it's about perspective. A lot of these reports suggest compassion and dignity are absent, and in some situations they are, and there is an excuse for that. But can we teach compassion? Can we teach spirituality? Can we teach dignity? I think it's multifaceted. We can emulate, we can provide example and role model in terms of qualities of that we should be displaying as practitioners. And we can do that in education, but equally we've got to have good role models out there in professional practice who were developing our students and our future workforce. But I think I did some work recently, and some of the work in the United Kingdom, nursing in England is moving to an all registration profession from 2013. So everybody will be trained to degree level. And some of the findings from some small studies that have been done suggest the further students progress on a 3-year programme, the less caring behaviours they exhibit. So we've got to explore that. Why is it because of education, or is it because what they're witnessing in practice? Some students will tell you they're motivated, they're enthusiastic, and then once they're socialised into practice, their motivation, their enthusiasm, the passion, the compassion is eroded. So I think, again, there's a whole range of issues that need to be explored, both educationally and clinically, in terms of what how we're supporting, how we're socialising students into our workforces.
Jürgen Strausberg from Munich. First of all, I would like to state that if you define old as being 65 years and older, then you are talking about the normal inpatient, at least in Germany, because half of the inpatients in Germany are 65 years and older. Then we have 1 million newborns and maybe 48% of inpatients being between 1 and 64. So if you talk about quality of care for older people, in that definition, you are talking about of quality of care in general.
Yep.
And my question is, do you think that it is possible to improve quality of care for older people in hospitals by measuring a quality of care with quality indicators. For example, thinking at the hospital centers dies mortality ratio, which is offered for England and maybe for UK by Dr. Foster.
I think they can give us an example of some of the standards. I don't think that that figures numerical data gives us any real insight into quality. One of the things I, in my role, do is I just go and sit and observe quality of care and the interaction and the standards of care being provided. And I probably glean more in observing and listening than I would from a survey in terms of a measure of indicator. So I think it's like I said earlier, I think we've got to use a whole range of approaches in order to measure quality, whether it's standardised mortality rates, statistics, whether it's surveys, whether it's observation, whether it's talking to patients. I think we've got to use a whole range of indicators to get quality. And I agree totally with you. One of the first things I did when I came into post was did an analysis of who were the inpatients in the hospital on one given day. And 68% were over the age of 65, and the largest group of that 68% were over 85. So it was the older in who were actually in hospital on that given day. So I think, and we've got to look at other reasons as well, not all older people feel able to complain, and I think that's what the Patients Association was highlighting, that we've got to support people. We've got to use a range of measures in order to try and capture that quality and the quality of that experience.
Donia Baldacchino from Malta. First of all, thank you for your presentation and analysis. With regards to the dignity of delivering care to patients, to elderly patients, or to elderly persons rather than patients. It appears that, first of all, I believe that it is, yes, it is a specialized, it is a specialty, you know, geriatrics. However, it appears that nurses and perhaps even other professionals might not consider it as working with older persons as a dignifying position in nursing. For example, in Malta, nurses, newly registered nurses, who are posted in to work with older persons, the minute they arrive there, they just ask for a transfer back to the general hospital, to the acute, to work in specialties. There is also research which hasn't been published as yet, that it appears that society looks down on nurses, on professionals who work with older people. How can we combat this issue? You know, at times when I go to older persons' institutions, I have conducted research and I met several nurses, and they told me, you know, I've already asked, but why is it that you don't reflect and try, you know, to stay for long, and then you realize the benefits of working with these people? So we have to bear in mind also that, unfortunately, in these older institutions, there are plenty of auxiliary nurses.
Yep.
And so the caring profession, it appears that has been transferred to these lower grade nurses.
And I think that's a good question, Donia, because I remember when I was in my nursing career, I remember applying for a promotion, and it was just at the time when all the nursing was moving into a lot of the specialist roles, and there was an opportunity came up in the trust I was working to either go for a specialist in diabetes nursing or a senior nurse in care of the older person, and I went for the job as care of the older person, senior nurse in care of the older person. And one of the senior managers in the trust who was supporting me, was acting as a mentor in my career, rang me and said, why are you going to care of the older person? It's a dead-end job. And there was an assumption even then that these specialist roles were more preferable than caring for older people. But my counter-argument to that was I learned more about myself, about the concept of caring, well, more importantly, caring, working with caring for older people than I did in any specialist role. And I would add in many of the roles of my nursing career. So it's about perception, it's about discrimination, it's about ageism. And those are the issues that we've got to challenge. It's how do we work intergenerationally to break down some of these perceptions of ageing. And it's like I said at the outset, the image of an older person is somebody who's ill, who's got comorbidity and complex morbidity. That isn't always the case. This slide I showed with the lady at 92 skydiving, that was only one illustration I could have pulled off from off Google. So not everybody is... That stereotypical image of an older person isn't a reality. And we in society have got to challenge that in whichever country we live and work. That's got to be... We've got to challenge those perceptions.
Is this working? Yes. Kate Lowenthal from the UK, Glendower University and elsewhere. This is a complicated question, although it's very simple. So can I start with a simple question and then elaborate very, very slightly? First of all, thank you for a very beautiful and moving presentation. I don't know whether beautiful is the right word because there were so many horrifying examples,
yeah, yeah.
But beautiful in the sense that it's inspiring. The simple version of the question is, should or could one be injecting the notion of spirituality more explicitly into inspiring or training caring professionals to become more compassionate, more respectful of dignity, and so on? You started off with a wonderful skirmish describing the history of your difficult relationships with the concept of spirituality and its definition. And at one point you said something extremely interesting, which is that it involves the concept of the person as a fundamentally spiritual being. Then you went off into... I forget whose list it was, but it was one of these wonderful lists, boxes and so on, which included basically every virtue, compassion and so on, and said that was spirituality. But now I'm back to my original question. That list of virtues doesn't explicitly have anything to do with the concept of the person as a spiritual being. In theory, we could all be training people to be caring and compassionate without mentioning words like soul or spirit or whatever. Thank you for listening so patiently to my question.
But I thought I was at the, and I apologise not for being able to be with you for the start of your conference, but over the last couple of days we've just held the British Association for the Study of Spirituality conference, and I know people have flown in like me straight from there. To hear, and one of the debates around there was is about spirituality, the immanence of spirituality, and the transcendence of spirituality, and some of the debate is around, is spirituality purely a psychosocial construct, or is it more to spirituality than it being just something physical, something psychological? And I think the point you're saying is that list, we could address that list by meeting the psychosocial needs of a person. So what is it? What is different about spirituality? And it is, I think it's about focusing on some of the transcendent nature of our being, and getting people in nursing and healthcare to reflect on what that might be. Because again, some of the research I've done, not everybody would even subscribe to the belief of a spirituality. And then there's the ethics of that. Is it right that we're education professionals who are coming to be nurses and healthcare practitioners, should we be raising that level of awareness with them? So there's some ethical debates as well. In my opinion, yeah, we should.
Well, there is time left for just one or two short questions. Anyone? Yes? Over here.
I'm Orjan Braam from the Netherlands, Utrecht, and a psychiatrist. In medical training in the Netherlands, we copied the KenMed system. I don't know whether, no. And that is a system of seven, well, sort of types of competencies for, to teach the students the basic values of professionals.
Yeah.
Although the word value is not included explicitly. I don't know whether such a system in which professionalism and communication are important themes is also the case for nursing, but normally I think teaching in nursing is ahead of medical teaching in this way at looking at values. I would be very careful to be too explicit about spirituality, but you never can be explicit enough about values, I think.
Yep, yep.
Also in the face of insurance companies or in making policy. So I think you add a lot in introducing or reminding us of the value of dignity.
Yeah.
I'm very thankful for that. So.
Well, one of the challenges I have in an academic role is getting funding for research. And if I put the word spirituality on a funding proposal, the chances were it won't even get through the first screen, first round. If I put the word core values or dignity, it's looked at a bit more positively. So it's how, for me, I mean, I don't think we shouldn't undermine and we shouldn't neglect the word spirituality. It should be explicit. But it's, if we link it to other concepts that are perhaps don't have the emotional laden or value that sometimes a judgment placed on words like spirituality because it's viewed synonymous with religion. There's a whole range of reasons why people look at the word spirituality negatively. But I think you're right. One of the things I'm moving away from now is talking about spiritual care. Rather than spiritual care, I'll talk about integrated care. So it's looking at the whole, it's looking at the core value of the individual, and spirituality is an integral part of that.
Well, thank you again for a very important, interesting, and indeed, in a sense, moving presentation. Yep. Thank you. We'll have a break now for about 30 minutes, so please be back at 10:30. Then we'll go on with the second part of this morning's program.
Can I just sit? Straight off the press as well, there's the Journal for the Study of Spirituality that's been published. I've brought a couple of inspection copies that I'll leave here if people want to look at them. And I know there are some flyers out on the desk in the front, but that'll give you an example of what it looks like. Thank you.